Hi, I'm Nigel Baker, and you're listening to The Future Financial Advisor. We're running this podcast to create an avenue for advisors to share their thoughts and their best interests and really trying to attract those advisors who want to take the industry forward. What we want is great businesses who are really making a difference and really making a big impact to their clients, and we want to know how they're doing it. So in this series, we're going to be discussing the latest digital platforms, some best practices, evidence-based investing strategies. We want to give financial advisors the tools they need to help more investors improve their financial well-being. So if you're ready to take the industry forward, modernise your advisory practice and reach a new generation of investors and the new generation of advisors, then this show is for you.
So all our recordings and podcasts are general advice. All the content, all the people interviewing here, it's all their own opinions and all their own views. In no way does it constitute any personal advice or recommendations. If you need specific advice, please go and seek an advisor. Thanks very much. So good morning, everyone. I'm here this morning with Chris Holcomb. How are you, Chris?
Very well. Thanks, Nigel. How are you?
Yeah, good. Good to have you here in person in the office. So now Chris has been our compliance manager since we started the business. It's been amazing for us. But interestingly, Chris's career came out of the AFP and joined the industry in 1998. Yeah, Chris, tell me a little bit about your story. How did you end up what you're doing today?
Back in 98, I'd taken a redundancy and decided to get out of the industry and start afresh. Was out of work for 6 days and got approached by a well-known advisor in Sydney saying, what do you know about financial planning? I said, nothing. And he said, great. I mean, do you know any financial planners? I said, no, don't know any. He said, you're the man for me. And the next thing I know, I've joined this particular license as his compliance and training manager because of my previous experience, and worked with him for 3 years and moved to another licensee called Matrix, then moved to another licensee called Paragem, and then finally, after Paragem was gone and Pathway was gone, started my own business with my business colleague, Michael Roll. So between us, Michael and I have got 60 years of experience in financial services.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of stories there in the industry, and some probably can't put on the record, but you've seen so many changes. I mean, this industry is going through more changes and probably rightly so. But what do you see right now as some of the key issues going on in the industry?
Well, I think one of the things that I've noticed since the Royal Commission,
yep,
that the big industry providers, the banks, have now got out of financial planning completely.
Mm.
ASIC introduced these new requirements for exams to be done. Back in January 19, there were 29,000 financial advisors on the ASIC register. And as at today's date, there's only 14,000 on the register. There's 17,000, but the other three are stockbrokers and derivatives traders and foreign exchange dealers, etc. But true financial planners have dropped basically by 50%.
Mm.
The other interesting stat is that 60% of the planners are 50 and above,
yeah,
which means basically there's only around 5,000 financial planners under the age of 50.
Wow.
And on top of that, those that are above 50, there's a lot in that 60 range who are going to exit within the next 3 to 5 years as well. So there's certainly going to be a dearth of financial advisors,
yeah,
in the short term anyway.
Yeah. And do you think, these changes, you've been on the front line with a lot of these advisory businesses and probably seen, mm-hmm, some pretty scary things. Do you think what they did was right? Do you think that's what needed to happen?
I don't know about right. I think that there was a reaction that there certainly were cowboys in the industry, but I think there's been an overreaction.
Yeah.
I think the exam has killed a lot of financial planners' businesses, because these are people that have got a CFP, a CPA, commerce degree, bachelor's degrees in finance, very well educated,
yeah,
professionals,
yeah,
and they just don't want to do the exam, or they've just decided, hang on, I'm not going to do all this additional education that's been put on me at 50 or 60,
yeah,
and have walked away or sold their business.
Yeah, I mean, it's been huge. I mean, from an industry go basically half in numbers, and of that, again, half are probably on the way out the door.
Yeah.
So you're almost going down to a quarter of the advisor population, so to speak, in 3 or 4 years.
And the end result is the cost of providing advice has gone through the roof because of all the new requirements for signatures, annual reviews, endorsements from platform providers that they can have the fees deducted on an annual basis.
Yep.
All of these additional costs of sending out to clients,
yep,
has meant that the fees have got to go up.
Yep.
And the end result now is that people are going to pay a fee probably two or three terms higher than they did 12 months, 18 months ago.
Yeah.
And representatives are cleaning up their client bases, and anybody who doesn't have enough funds under management are going to be told you need to find another advisor.
Yeah, but there's no advisors out there.
Yeah. So there's also the industry funds, but with the industry funds, the industry funds can only talk about superannuation.
Mm.
So they're not the answer.
Yeah.
The common thread there is that the industry fund can only recommend their fund.
Yeah.
There's a conflict there when they can only use their own product, which is what happened with the banks.
Yeah, exactly. We're going back to where we started.
Yeah.
It's a huge issue there. Numbers, the advisors we're speaking to are all saying the same thing. You know, the good advisors out there are flat out and they're struggling to keep up with the demand, but at the same time, the last 4 or 5 years have been, it's been taxing on them.
Yeah.
All the study, having to, you know, lose staff who've been great staff have decided to leave, really hard to find new staff. But there's demand there. Like, there's people who want advice, and there's existing clients who are happy to keep paying, but there's a huge gap, which we're all aware of. And Michelle Levy, with the Quality Advice Review, has brought in some proposals. There's been a lot of debate about that, around good advice, around, topics around who can give advice, all that sort of thing. What are your thoughts on what her proposals?
Look, having read what she's done, it's a breath of fresh air, but I can't see the government taking it on board.
Yeah.
They went to a lot of effort to introduce best interests so that you had to act in the client's best interests. Mm. You need to gather enough information to make an informed decision on the products you're recommending.
Mm.
Michelle's has gone that a little bit too far.
Yeah.
It's basically no statements of advice, no document, no documentation apart from a file note potentially.
Yep.
And I can't see the government allowing that because of all the money they've spent on the Royal Commission and to reform the industry itself.
Mm.
I can't see them doing a backflip on that as well. So it's chase your tail, really.
Yeah, I can see it's refreshing where she's looking at it, saying, look, I think we've got this profession and we're going to trust them to do the right thing and give good advice. The challenge is we've all seen what's happened in the past, and you've particularly seen it. You've seen what happens when people, at the moment they're given all sorts of regulations and they still don't apply by them. Mm-hmm. So everyone's scared that if they don't have a prescriptive set of rules, what will happen? It'll be chaos. I think there's some real positives out of that. I mean, obviously, to free up the advice, and there's no doubt that, I mean, you've reviewed a lot of statements of advice. You'd be a pretty good person to comment. Do they add any value?
I still see statements of advice 82 pages long. I saw one last week.
Who's going to read that?
And nobody's going to read it.
Yeah.
And the last 20 pages are disclaimers and signing away, accepting no responsibility and time limitations, and that they serve no purpose. ASIC sent out some sample SOAs a few years ago.
Mm.
They're about 16 pages long, but they didn't have any figure disclosure in them.
No.
And the most important thing is, how much am I going to pay?
Yeah.
And it wasn't there.
Yeah.
So I think we could, if we could get a statement of advice that was around 20 pages long, basically said, this is what your position is, this is what you want to do, this is what we propose, and this is what we're going to cost, that would be great. Everybody would understand it and get a short form statement of advice.
Yeah. I can sort of see where she's going, though. I've been a chartered accountant as well, and she's a lawyer. And I mean, I can, someone can walk in the door here today, if I'm a chartered accountant, and ask me, questions around tax, and I don't need to write them a 20-page letter. I can actually just talk to them and have a professional, and they know that I'm going to try and give them the right advice. And if it's more complicated than that, I'll probably refer them to someone that's beyond our scope. If it's an international tax ruling or a GST technicality, that's my professional obligation to say, look, I can answer that or I can't, and this is what you should do in a simple email. Now, that sort of works. So I totally get your view that statements of advice are required, but I do see where she's going, saying, I know it's a scary position to have no statements of advice.
Yeah.
Something in the middle, maybe, letter of advice or something.
Got to be some sort of form of documentation.
Yeah. Yeah.
My wife always says to me, if it's not written down, it never happened.
Yeah, I agree with the writing part. I think
there has to be something in writing.
Yeah.
And there has to be knowledge from the client that they've seen it, they understand it, and they're happy to proceed.
Yeah.
There is no requirement for an ATP, authority to proceed, in the Act.
No.
But the licensees have always had this authority to proceed.
Mm.
And I do think there should be some acknowledgement that they've actually read it, they understand it, they're happy to pay the fee and to proceed. Mm. But again, one page.
Yeah. And it almost seems like, a specific question, but I'm sure you can answer this. It almost seems like the laws are all about retail clients. So what's happened is you've got people and
that's okay. I'm not having a go at them, but they've said, okay, we're not going to deal with retail because in wholesale you can do whatever you like.
Correct.
And my view is that I think that's wrong as well. I think that everyone should be getting advice. So if you've got $100 million or a dollar, you should still get something in writing. And that person with $100 million doesn't necessarily mean they might have sold a business that they don't know anything about investment markets. So they should at least get a letter in writing saying, hey, we're recommending you into these investments and here's the costs. And you're okay with that, you know, rather than say, oh, you're wholesale, you know, work it out for yourself. What's your view on that?
I took part in a Zoom meeting with a well-known law firm last Thursday, and it's another one of my clients, and they want to move a majority of their clients to wholesale. And the law firm is going to give them all the letters that they need for wholesale. But the story is that clients still need to know that they've got some rights under the wholesale. They have no rights. They've got no rights to complain to AFCA. They've got the only way they can complain is to the licensee. And if they don't get satisfaction with the licensee, legal action is the only way, and that's costly and time-consuming. And it's so there's got to be some sort of happy medium there by cutting on the documentation and still making the clients with enough information to make an informed decision whether to acquire the products.
So, let's see what happens. I mean, there's also the debate around the intra-fund advice. So you touched on that before. So obviously we've got this whole industry fund sector saying we want to give advice as well. And again, they're saying, well, we've got these millions of customers. They can't afford advice. So where do they go? And there's that dilemma of going, well, if you're an advisor working for an industry fund, obviously you're only going to recommend an industry fund. So how do we solve that?
Well, the other interesting thing with the industry funds is they have very limited authorisations. So they would have to go back to ASIC and have their licence varied to include managed investments, to include other products that's margin lending. They can't do self-managed super funds. There's nothing they can do except their own individual super fund. So for them to do it, they'd have to have their licence varied. I can't see the trustees allowing them to do those things. It's going to be a difficult situation with the industry funds. And the industry funds are all swallowing each other up because there's been, you know, a couple of years ago there might have been 200 of them and we're now down into double figures. And they're just buying one another out and getting bigger and bigger. But the problem still is all they can talk on is super.
And look, there's an element of them being able to provide some sort of service, so I understand that. Like, it'd be hard to say to all those millions of people, you know, in the industry fund, look, we can't help you. But I think it just has to be really, really clear that they are a representative of the industry fund and this isn't comprehensive advice. I can advise you on this product, that's all. If you don't think that's suitable for you and you want to check out the market, then hey, you're going to have to go and see someone else. Because otherwise, if they think they're getting personal advice through a product like the banks did, then this becomes too conflicted, right? That person's never going to be motivated to say, hey, this isn't for you, go to someone else.
Again, coming back to the industry funds, they can't do investments, for example. So if you've got some money to invest, they can't help you. And really what they're doing is general advice based on the one fund that you're already involved in or potentially going into their fund. But that's it. It's very limited advice. It's not wholesome. And that in itself is another thing that needs to be addressed as well.
So the advisors out there you're talking to, I mean, compliance is a huge headache, I suppose, for advisors. How are you finding them dealing with that? How are they managing that regime? Are there any tips out there? You're saying some really good businesses are using more technology, or are they just
a lot more technology is being used out there now. The process has been difficult because of COVID as well. So people have been disengaged or unable to attend. And I think it's like medicine. If you do telehealth, the doctor's only seeing you over a screen. The same with financial planning. You really want that personal touch of seeing somebody face to face rather than doing it over a Zoom meeting. And I think as COVID dissipates, we'll see more and more people starting to look for advice again. The other interesting thing is that the baby boomers, who control allegedly 60% of all the property in Australia, are now heading towards retirement in the next couple of years. And there's going to be more and more of those wanting to cash in and sell down their investment properties, their homes, and looking for quality advice. And they're happy to pay it because they will have the money to do it. But those in the lower age groups or even in the older age groups won't be able to pay for it because there isn't enough financial planners out there.
And it's hard to find. I mean, the education requirements have also limited the number of graduates coming through. So you know, in our experience here, we've got some great young graduates, but it's been really unclear for them what the pathway is.
Correct.
So that's stopped people joining the industry. They've got a lot of friends who don't want to know about the financial industry because they just look at it and think, that's too confusing. I want to go into an industry where I know what my pathway is, whether that's chartered accounting, law, banking, whatever. Whereas here, it's sort of like, well, you might not be able to do it. You might have to do this extra course. We're not sure. We'll come back to you in a year.
And that's just it. It's the uncertainty in relation to education.
Mm.
Because we had what was introduced, FASEA, but FASEA has now been dissolved by the government as of December last year.
Yeah.
ASIC seems to have taken over the role,
but
there's no clear water ahead. Yeah. There's nothing set out, this is what's going to happen in the next 5 years. So the uncertainty is there, and so younger graduates are looking somewhere else.
Yeah, it's a shame. So less advisors, no talent coming through, 60% of them are over 50 already. What's going to happen? Like, there's still, you know, the Australian population is growing. There's always baby boomers needing advice. Who's going to provide that advice? How's it going to happen?
Well, advice will be available, but it's going to come at a cost.
Mm.
And only those with money will be able to afford it.
Mm. Well, but the advisors, have they got capacity to...
I don't think they have capacity. Yeah. I know that most licensees are losing the low-hanging fruit from their client base because they just can't afford to provide ongoing advice to them unless clients pay a minimum fee.
Yeah. And it's very difficult for people to offer advice to someone who, you know, the fees have just gone up and up. And up.
And there's all the admin that's involved as well.
Yeah.
That's now the representatives had to, and licensees have had to take on board to ensure that the clients do have their annual review and documented and all these additional costs. And the one thing that's also important here is that PI, professional indemnity insurance, has gone up. It's very expensive now. There are only four in the market in Australia. AIG, which used to be the biggest provider of PI insurance, has pulled from Australia.
Yeah.
And anybody who's got an AIG policy will find when they come to renewal, it's not going to be renewed by AIG and find another insurer.
Wow, yeah. Busy days for you in your business.
Very much so. Every day is different.
So the main compliance concerns, I suppose, you're seeing are really just keeping on top of all this regulation, keeping an eye out for what's happening in the future, all these new changes. And I think, you know, talking to our advisors, this whole regulation change, I think there is a bit of a lack of, well, is this really going to happen? Obviously, if suddenly there's no SOAs, that changes the game completely.
I think financial planning is, at the moment, has fallen into the too hard basket. The government's got enough on its plate with the inflation, the war in Ukraine, the cost of living, etc. And we're a small industry compared to what everything else is going on, and I'd like to see something done sooner rather than later, and some clear water and some clear directions provided by the government and by ASIC on what they expect in the next 5 years so that we can plan accordingly. But unfortunately, at the moment, can't say what's going to happen.
Yeah, that would be good to have some clarity. One of the other big things that we're talking a lot internally, and we've seen the Optus breach, and it seems like every day now there's another one, but so cyber risk. Are you seeing advisors putting in much stricter policies around cyber?
Very much so, and the product issuers themselves have now come to the fore. As you would know, Macquarie's now checking phone calls, etc. But I'm aware of a number of incidents that have already happened this year where clients have been coerced out of their money from scams, etc. And I think the public is becoming more aware because it comes every night. There's a story on some scam or another. Has a story of an accountant had his website scammed, and a client received a letter saying, deposit this money to this accountant, because it came with the accountant's logo and website. The client did what he was told, sort of thing, and the money was gone. So it's but more and more resources are having to put into cyber. It's just, I think people need to be more aware and be more vigilant about any phone calls and any contacts from anybody in relation before they do anything at all.
Yeah, it's a big one, and I think people are more and more aware, but at the same time, I think some people, there's still a bit of a relax around, this isn't really going to happen to me, so people have to be very vigilant.
A bit too naive.
I mean, obviously, worst case, you see the cicadic stories of the world. But most businesses out there have got a lot of protection in place, and obviously, if they're using the reputable inquiries of the world, then things are pretty secure. So are you seeing any sort of, you know, best practice tips that you've got for any of the planners sitting in there today?
Look, what I am seeing is a lot of specialisation. So people that do certain clients, and I have a number of people that do special clients that they take on board, and one, he only does doctors.
Yeah.
And he only does doctors who specialists.
Yeah.
Another one who only does Qantas pilots.
Yeah.
So there is some specialisation that's occurring out there. There are those there that like to be, if you want to call them general practitioners, and take on anybody who comes in the door who are still there.
Yeah.
One of the things is the referral sources. There used to be a sort of a strong referral source from an accountant or from a solicitor, etc. In the olden times, there used to be some sort of payback to the accountant or to the solicitor for the referrals. Under the new requirements, you can't accept any benefits of that kind. So the referring section sort of dried up in some cases.
Yeah.
They're not getting the referrals that they used to.
Yeah.
But that, on the other hand, is good because they can then spend more attention with the clients that they've got now.
That's right, yeah.
They don't need the referrals.
Professional, yeah. Yep, I agree with that. I think it always should be just arm's length. That's great, Chris. I mean, obviously, we've had a great experience of your advice and counsel over the years, and making sure as an independent, you know, as a small licensee, it's been great. There might be people listening who are bigger groups. How do people get in contact with you? And, you're probably pretty busy anyway, but I assume you're still happy to take on. If advisors are out there looking for some great help around all these issues, able to contact you?
My business partner and I are always happy to help people. We particularly like the small licensee area. We don't have, our biggest client probably has 25 reps on their license. But the ones we normally look at are the 1, 2, three-man licensees, the three-person licensees. Interesting, one of my clients did a survey and about the loss of representatives, and he's in Sydney, but he's found that there are no financial planners south of Batemans Bay to the Victorian border now. And so he's now set himself up to go and do a bit of locum work, but he's formed a relationship with an accountant down in Maruya, and because of who he spoke to, and he's now going there one day a fortnight to Maruya for the day.
It's a nice spot to go.
Nice spot to go. But the industry has shrunk that much that, yes, there are a couple, there are people in Batemans Bay, but they're fly-ins from Canberra, so they come down for the weekend and they share an office with somebody like that. But we're talking about the shortage of GPs around Australia in the medical profession, but there's certainly a shortage of financial planners, particularly in rural and you'd think areas on the coast or area would be somewhere where somebody would strive to start up a practice, but apparently they're shriveling up as well too. So people on the coast and people inland certainly are missing out.
Yeah.
Industry funds are getting rid of some of their representatives too. They're trying to cut costs. So the industry is sort of shriveling, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Well, let's hope that we turn the corner and there's better days ahead. Obviously, part of the things we're looking at is that technology solution and helping advisors, sort of those, especially those clients where we think obviously the good practices are obviously moving up and saying, well, we want to look after more complex clients. Well, how do you service those clients that in between that, or people get referred that aren't ideal? You don't necessarily want to say, hey, we can't help you. So obviously with Santium, we've got a tech solution to try to keep managing those clients and give them an experience, a really low-cost experience, but without having to say, no, sorry, we just can't help you and send you back to it.
And that's a service offering that's out there now that many young people would like to take on board because they're not, I won't say they're disengaged, they're just not at that stage in their life where they want to seek, because they see, well, we've got a lot of debt and we don't have many assets, so what's the point of seeing a planner when now's the time to start doing something about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chris, that's been really informative. I'm sure everyone's enjoyed this today. We'll have your contact details in the bio as well. If anyone wants to reach out to Chris, send him an email, give him a call, and I'm sure you'll have a great experience. So thanks again for your time this morning.
Thank you, Nigel.
Thanks for your time on the podcast.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
You've been listening to The Future Financial Advisor. So if you've been enjoying the show, please make sure to share it with your network and leave a review on your favourite listening platform. Or if you've got some ideas or thoughts or would like to come on as a guest or know someone who would be a great guest, then please let me know. To learn more about Santium, just go to our website, santium.com.au, or look me up on LinkedIn. Look forward to speaking with you and see you on the next episode.